part one of the lecture on the religious and the theological causes and background of secession. I want to say to you, the people here today, that I'm very happy to have been asked back to give this lecture, because this group, association, had tried many times to get me, and it always conflicted, the date always conflicted with my role and the faculty of the Greenville Seminary at the commencement time, and I couldn't do it. But this time I could. And so I'm glad to do this for you today by tape, since I was providentially hindered from coming to you because of illness in the family. And now let's look at the situation. I mentioned to you that I was going to lecture to you on the theological and the religious background and support for and causes of secession. That might seem like a contradiction, because if you look in the leading textbooks and the leading writers of this day, and even of past days, you will find nothing about such a cause. Oh, you will find the economic factors set forth, you will find the political factors set forth, and even the cultural factors set forth. And I would not deny that all of these played a role. This is not a question of either or, but what lay behind these other factors? What lay behind the economic? What lay behind the political? What lay behind the cultural forces? This, I think, is the basic question which secular historians either do not know, are not aware of, or know and do not want to discuss in a book. Because today, as you know, you have to be politically correct to have a book published. In fact, you have to be politically correct to teach in most of the major universities and, of course, many colleges. And so today I would devote our attention to this point. And in so doing, I would ask your attention to go with me as I go back and turn in the pages of American history. Yes, for a time even in English, constitutional history. For here we have the roots of our dilemma, if you want to call it that, for the causes of the war between the states. And notice, I always use that phrase, because I accept the war of Northern aggression, but I do not accept the, quote, the Civil War idea, unquote, or any other such title. Having cleared the decks of such misunderstandings, you will find the theological background, you will find the constitutional background, you will find the legal background for the movement for secession in British history. And you say, well, it couldn't go back that far. Oh, yes, it could, and oh, yes, it did. Because lurking behind the whole secession movement was a very interesting and very valuable concept of political theory, and, of course, of the formation of the Constitution. And that is the idea of covenant and of law, and the two are closely bound together. In 1100, Henry II came to the English throne and began a process, a procedure, which was destined to have a tremendously important consequence, not only for the history of Great Britain, but also for the history of the United States. And that was found in the famous phrase, the Judges of Dusty Feet, which was the popular name for those jurists whom Henry I sent around England to be sure that the court law, the law of the court, the law of the court was made the common law of the land. And they were known as the courts of dusty feet. For in that day, the jurists actually went back on horseback, I suppose in a few carriages, but they grew very dusty as they went around the countryside. And that is the popular name, but actually it was the court of King's Bench en route around England. Now this law, which they enforced, and which became common law because it was commonly held, and I want to make that point very clear. It was a law of the court. It was the whole legal system of the royal court that was made the common law of England. And this common law was feudal law. And immediately, when we come to the term feudal, we come to a concept of law which involves the whole idea of covenant. And it is this I want to discuss with you briefly. This court system was begun by Henry I, but it was also who ruled from 1100 to 1135, and then, perhaps more importantly, by Henry II, who ruled from 1154 to 1189, a period of 35 years in which he carried forward and gave a firmer foundation to the legal practices begun by Henry I. Now, this idea, of course, of feudal system and feudal law is often looked down upon today. But we must remember that what became the common law of Great Britain was basically biblical law. True enough, there were other elements in it. There were some Roman elements in it in regard to the nature of the feudal system and its landholding. But the everyday law, which was carried out by the royal courts and, of course, by the curia regis and by the courts of Dusty Feet, was basically a feudal law based upon, and so far as its everyday concepts are concerned, it based upon Scripture, the Ten Commandments, and all the other elements of law which are found in the Scriptures and which should still be in vogue and which were in vogue in that day. Now this, of course, this common law became the basis for the famous Magna Carta of 1215 and was thoroughly ingrained into English practice. Not always upheld by kings, of course not. Kings are human and we need not expect, but the foundation of English law, English common law, were definitely Christian. Now, I have to skip a great deal of English history to the days of the founding of the colonies. And this is where this concept becomes tremendously important. Basic to feudal law was the idea of covenant. In fact, the word feudal, coming from a Latin word, foedus, means covenant, a binding on all sides. Feudal law involved agreements of covenants between the lord and his vassals, and between the vassals and the serfs. And we need to keep this in mind. Now, let's go down to the days of James I of England and the founding of the colonies. When these colonies, I'm taking them collectively now, when these colonies were formed, or I should say chartered, beginning with the one to the London Company in 1606, these charters included some very, very important provisions, one of which was this, that English common law would be the law of the particular colony, meaning that the colonial legislatures, when they began to operate, would enact laws in harmony with the British common law. Secondly, that these colonies would establish Christianity as the religion of that colony. Now, it's not all these charters were worded in the same way, but all the 13 colonies were regarded as being extensions of British law and of the British religious system in the Church of England. Now, it is important to remember that when these charters were issued, the Church of England, although an Episcopal church in form of government, was largely Calvinistic. You may remember that Calvin even approved of the Church of England as a Christian commonwealth in the days of Edward VI, when he and Cranmer put through some of the important legislation, the First Book of Common Prayer and the 39 Articles Act. These great foundations of Christian faith, which are the basis for the Church of England, were expected to be and required to be made part of the religious foundations of the colonies. So that the colonies, when founded, were expected and required to enact laws which were in accordance with and contained the elements of English common law, which meant that the idea of covenant was very firmly planted and embraced in the colonial legal system. I kind of overestimate the importance of this. Now, you will find that not many courses in English constitutional history will embrace this. But if you will look at the English records and the colonial records, you will find that this is the case. I might say at this point in my discussion with you that I am giving you a great deal of material that is found in Thorpe's Charters and Documents. This is an important collection put into print by the Library of Congress and collected by Dr. Thorpe, who was the head of the manuscript division. In fact, excuse me, he was the librarian of the Library of Congress, and he collected all the known documents dealing with the relationships between the colonies and the mother country, starting in 1606 and of course ending in 1776. But a period there of 170 years, Thorpe collected all the important documents issued by the Crown and the Privy Council for the government of the colonies. This is a gold mine of theological information, of constitutional information, and of legal information. I do not know why modern law schools do not pay more attention to this very important collection of documents. If you want to check any library today, which is a depository of the Library of Congress, and they are so designated, should have this book within their collection, or these books. I think they're four volumes. They should also have Otis Debates, and I will come to them in a minute. But right now, I want to discuss with you this very, very important issue of the legal foundation of the colonies. Because written into these legal foundations was the whole idea of a covenant, a theological covenant translated into a political relationship between the colonies and the mother country. This may sound strange to you, and you may say, well, I never heard this in my courses in English history. That's probably true. And you may say, I never heard this in my courses in American history. I'm sure that's true. But I happened to be blessed when I walked into graduate school and into class. I found myself in an American constitutional history course with Dr. H. V. Ames. Now that name may not ring a bell with you, but in his day, in the late teens, in the 20s and the 30s, he was one of the three leading constitutional historians then teaching this country. Ames was an interesting man to me. He had been and still was president of the Mayflower Society of America. He was a direct descendant of William Ames, one of the first great English Puritan writers. And I always thought, well, he looked like William Ames. He talked like William Ames. And he almost was William Ames, but he wasn't. He was Dr. H.B. Ames, a noted constitutional authority, who wrote some very, very important material on the American constitutional system, which is hardly ever mentioned today. But it is there and can be used, and I would say should be used. So much for that. So let's go on now to the next very important point. And that is, of course, the separation from Great Britain, the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence, of course, took effect on July the 4th, 1776. That's in final form. Now, that was the invitation for the colonies to rearrange their governments. Obviously, the English royal governors were no longer to be there, and there would be elected governors elected by the people of the various colonies. But interestingly enough, whatever Franklin and Jefferson and their fellow radicals had in mind, there was no such thing as a legal revolution. The English legal tradition, if I might use that term, continued to be the legal tradition, the legal underpinning for all the political and the legal activities of the colonial governments. So that English common law was written into the American legal system. As a matter of fact, it was required by the colonial charters that English common law in this main provision should be written into the colonial law system. And it's still there, as far as I know, in North Carolina. If I remember correctly, it's chapter 17. So this concept of a covenant was brought into the American political tradition. And I might add that this whole idea of a covenantal relationship was much more prevalent in colonial thinking, certainly among the leadership, than it is today.
it played an important role in the colonial attempts to unify, beginning with the Albany Congress, 1754, and coming down, of course, ultimately, 33 years later, to the writing of the Constitution. The idea of covenants hung heavily in the political thinking, the political air, the political atmosphere of that day. So now what do we have? Well, we have a colonial political system, legal system, now being translated into an early state legal system in the various states. There was very little change in the laws, except those, of course, dealing with the relationship of that particular colony to Great Britain. Obviously, those were changed. But for the everyday legal life of the colonies, for the everyday legal practice, for the everyday application of law to particular problems, whatever they might be, the idea of English common law was still prevalent, still used in the legal practices of the day. This is extremely important. Now, there were several reasons for this. The leading colonial lawyers, John Adams, John Jay, James Wilson, Pennsylvania, John Rutledge of South Carolina. These men, John Dickinson of Pennsylvania and then of Delaware, these men had been trained in the English common law. Some of them, like Rutledge and Dickinson, had gone to the Inns of Court, which were the famous law schools in London, where they were thoroughly indoctrinated into English law. And when they came back and took their seats in Congress or in the state governments, they were, of course, they did use, of course, the legal training which they had received in Great Britain. But those who had not gone to Great Britain and who read law, quote and unquote, with leading lawyers, also were deeply impressed and affected by this whole legal system. We come now to the formation of the Constitution. And this, of course, is a very, very important point. The Philadelphia Convention of 1787 was composed of 56 extremely able men, some more able than others. But on the whole, it was probably the greatest political gathering we've ever witnessed in this nation. One exception I might add, and this is not my position necessarily, but some historians have held that the Congress of 1850 was equal in ability. I doubt that, but I'm not going to argue the point. But there's no doubt that the men of 1787 were deeply conscious of their heritage. They were well read in history. They were well trained and well read in English law, English common law, and so on. So that when they met in 1787, the idea of a covenant was freshly in their minds. As a matter of fact, the Articles of Confederation, adopted by the Congress in 1778 and becoming effective in 1781 when Maryland finally ratified, the Articles of Confederation were really a covenantal agreement. So that the idea of a covenant was translated over now from the colonies into the early forms of a union of states. We need to remember this. So we come to 1787. Now, whatever else you can say about the Constitution, it was a great document formed by very, very able men. But they were really trying to restore a British system of government to an independent nation. Men like Madison, Hamilton, Jay, James Wilson, John Rutledge, John Dickinson, and so on. The men who were in that Philadelphia Convention were extremely good, not only in the letter of the law, not only in the idea of law that way, but in the philosophy of law. Yea, I might even say of the theology of law. Because they recognized that law is not of human origin, but of divine origin. And of course, this was one of the leading characteristics of the British system of law until the advent of democracy. And it remained in force in this country and is not entirely absent from us today, but does not have the force or the vigor in political thinking that it once had, and which it should have today, but that's another story. I simply want to deal with this today from the point of view of the development of the idea of the covenant in American law. Because if you catch this idea, you will understand much more easily and much more readily, and I would say probably more completely, the theory of secession and the validity of secession. I don't need to go into the structure of the new government with you, I don't think, at this time. But I do want to discuss with you something behind this. And that is the debate in the various states. Eliot, another librarian for the Library of Congress, gathered together all the debates in all of the 13 states on the adoption of the Constitution and of the adoption of the Bill of Rights. And it is interesting. I never hear of Eliot being cited. I've asked law students if they've ever heard of Eliot, or if they've ever heard of Thorpe, and the answer is no. Well, this is part of the impoverishment which modern law has endured at the hands of radicals and liberals and those who believe in political correctness. Because Eliot's debate is another gold mine. And here we think, here we see, here we feel what the founding fathers really intended. Because many of the men in the Constitutional Convention went back to their respective states and became members of their legislatures and of their adopting conventions. And it is in these adopting conventions that we see what was really at stake and what the First Amendment and all the amendments meant. I might also point out that these amendments were adopted because North Carolina and Virginia and one or two other states had refused to accept the Constitution, Rhode Island was one of them, until the 10th Amendment were written into that document. And those 10th Amendments really constitute the nerve core of the idea of the covenant. It is in these amendments that the covenantal nature of the American Republic becomes clearly observable, becomes openly obvious, and should be, I note the word should be, our guide today. Just let me tell you what I mean. The First Amendment forbids Congress to enter into any agreement, any position. Congress cannot control religion. It shall not establish religion, but neither can it interfere with religion in the states. The First Amendment today has been used in just the reverse, by a queer twist, to justify congressional activity, congressional control over religion in the various states. Because the Ten Amendments, the whole Ten Amendments, were not restrictions on the states. They were restrictions on the Congress. As a matter of fact, two states maintained their position of supporting the clergy of their denominations up until the 1819 for one, 1843 or 44 for the other. They were Connecticut and Massachusetts. They had established church states, or established church in the states, for 50 years after the adoption of the federal constitution, and it was not challenged. I mention that because the war between the states resulted in an overturning of the whole covenantal idea in the states, in the federal government, and in the state legislatures. The 14th and 15th Amendments, whatever good they might have done, were a devastating blow at the whole concept of government, as that concept was expressed in the Philadelphia Convention and in the state ratifying convention. And I want to make this point very, very, very clear to you. But be that as it may, we'll come back later, maybe, I hope. But right now, I want to make it clear that this covenantal idea became the basic concept which entered into the adoption of the Constitution. Without the Ten Amendments, the Bill of Rights, it is most unlikely that the Constitution would ever have been adopted. Now, I would make this further point as we go along in the story. It was agreed that these Ten Amendments, the Bill of Rights, were not only to be placed in the Constitution to make it acceptable to the states, but that they were not to be overthrown, they were not to be changed. They were the immovable part of that Constitution. And we have forgotten that today. In our zeal, in our ignorance, we have done great harm to the First Amendment, we have done great harm to the Fifth Amendment, and we have done devastating harm to the Tenth Amendment. Those three amendments have been under increasing attack. And that they were the mainstay. They were the reason that the Constitution was adopted in good faith. Now, this challenge to the nature of the Ten Amendments was not challenged too much in the early years of the Republic. And I'm going to make a point here, because I think you need to understand that and understand this. The Constitution at no time was written to preserve, to ordain, or to foster, or to encourage, or to form a democracy. As a matter of fact, many times within the debates in the Philadelphia Convention, the idea of democracy was abhorred, and it was very plainly stated that the Constitution was formed to prevent, note, I say to prevent the form of a democracy, because you cannot have a covenantal relationship, you cannot have a covenantal idea of government in the fold of democracy. Democracy and freedom are directly opposed. And you say, well, what heresy am I shouting? No, I'm not. I'm trying to bring a great point to you, which is very, very, very important. Very important. So, not until the growth of the abolitionist movement did the Ten Amendments really come under attack. There were attempts to amend the Constitution, but not in the Ten Amendments, the First Ten Amendments. There were attempts, of course, to evade it in New England. As a matter of fact, before the War of 1861 came, there wasn't a northern state then in existence which at one time or not another had not believed in evading and in preventing a federal law from being carried out within its borders. The whole idea of the South had been adopted by the North. As a matter of fact, some of the northern states had threatened to secede, at least one of them did, if the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed. So even the idea of secession. Dr. Ames, the man I mentioned, wrote a very great book dealing with state relations and the federal government and the Constitution from 1787 down till 1861, in which he examined every attempt at secession, every attempt at nullification. And there were as many, perhaps even more, attempts at nullification in the North as there were in the South, for various reasons, of course. But pervading all of the thinking, the great thinking, was the idea of a covenant. If you have ever read John C. Calhoun's Disquisition on Government, you will see it clearly set forth there. If you look at his other great work, published after his death, that Disquisition of the Constitution, it becomes even more obvious there in the application of the Constitution to political matters in this country. I do not know the census. I'm not trying to say how many of the leaders in that period believed in covenant, but they did believe in a covenant relationship in the realm of government. There's no question about it. Now, that covenant relationship developed out of and was a product of covenant theology. And you say, oh, what about the evangelical? I repeat what I said. If you study the religious history of the American people, if you study the history of, shall I say, religious and theological debate, you will find that what I say is true. you will find that all radicalism in this country, I mean political, social, and economic radicalism, had its roots in a rejection of historic covenant theology. Because all radicals today, as then, realize that if they can destroy Calvinism, if they can destroy the idea of a covenant theology, of a covenant government, they can have their way with the whole political outlook. They can win. They can triumph over the church. They can triumph over Christian people. They can triumph over the American political and constitutional heritage. They know that. And they're far more aware of this than many of us are. Because we, as a people, have not appreciated the great heritage which is ours. Now, in the time which is left to me, and I do not have much, I see, the American people underwent a vast intellectual change in the 19th century. And I'm referring, of course, to transcendentalism as it made its way into the thinking of a large number of people, leaders, and brought great changes into the thinking of the American people at large. American transcendentalism was derived from British sources, from the British Romantic movement, and that in turn was produced by Kant and Hegel. So that transcendentalism and the British Romantic movement, and particularly the Hegelian philosophy and the Kantian philosophy of early 19th century Germany, were distinctly anti-Christian. When transcendentalism came to this country, and it came and it was first noticed in 1819 in the ordination service for Jared Sparks in the Unitarian Church in Baltimore, Maryland, where this Unitarian transcendental idea was clearly spoken. Basically, that the period of, say, 1820 to 1860, 1865 in this country was a period of social and economic upheaval, of attempts at reform, and the appearance of many heretical groups within the church and outside the church, of dangerous political developments in the hands of the early socialist Robert Owen and that group, and of the social implications, and Fanny, what's her name, from Scott, Fanny Wright from Scotland, who came to this country advocating free love and so on and so on. All of this became embroiled in what was known as the Age of Reform, from that full 40, 45 years, which wrought vast changes. And the war between the states is the product of this climactic or charismatic change, this transcendentalist outlook in the country, which affected practically every aspect of American life. And the South reacted against this for reasons which I'll discuss in the next lecture. And so I say thank you right now. All modern idealism, in spite of the high-sounding phrase of idealism, really harkens over to some form of a corporate totalitarian state. Now, I should point out to you in passing that Kant came to this country in the form of transcendentalism. He came to England in the form of the English idealism or romanticism. But Lord Byron, Coleridge, Keats, Shelley, all these men shared certain concepts which they derived from Kant. And you may remember, very interesting enough, they all were devoted to freedom, but it was a Kantian view of freedom, a transcendental freedom. This came out of this country in the form of transcendentalism. Now, transcendentalism, dedicated to the ideal of freedom, nevertheless produced in this state, in this country, the concept of the corporate state. Calling for big government, calling for what we call centralized socialism. It has that peculiar twist which I can't really go into too much, as much as I'd like to. Now, let me give you a summary of Kant to answer some of your questions, which you have
well raised. Let me point out to you that no matter whether your presuppositions are those of empiricism or those of traditional rational analytic arts, and there's a Leibniz or Locke, Berkeley, Hume, and so on. No matter which school of thought you belong in, when that school of thought decides that it can find its own unaided reason on the one hand, or its unaided sensationalism through the senses on the other, come to knowledge that man may create his own preconception, his own presupposition. In that sense, I'm using rationalism in another sense. This sense in which I'm using rationalism is that man is the forerunner, the precursor of his own knowledge. He lays down the presuppositions by which he will know, and then he will decide. He decides what he will know and what he won't know, what's worth knowing. He will otherwise decide the truth, what is truth. Now, for some of you, yes, John.
I'm understanding you said a man finds his personality in the state. Is that a philosophical presupposition, or is that a historical one?
It's both. Where does it get to be? Where do we get that? Well, just from the idea of the superior
German faith. Is Tyson's question? No.
Excuse me for a moment. Now, come on,
sir.
Some of you have heard this, I don't know if all have or not, but for the sake of emphasis and for the sake of the rest of the course, for the sake of all of you who lecture, when you give your lecture, I would like to read to you again Einstein's definition of truth from the state of Einstein. Einstein of Canterbury, please. Truth is a rectitude perceptible only by the soul. The thought of God is the measure of all things. If you don't like the sound, I'll do it very boldly. Truth is a rectitude perceptible only by the soul. The thought of God is the measure of all things. Truth is a rectitude perceptible only by the soul. The thought of God is the measure of all truth, by which he meant the thinking of God, by which he meant the mind of God. Now, the third sentence, if you're ready, but things are true in so far as they are conformed to the thought of God. With our thinking is true insofar as it is conformed to the nature of things. I'll hear something like that, whoever. Yeah, sure. I couldn't tell where it came from. Our thought is true insofar as it is conformed to the nature of things and to the divine model which they, meaning those things, reproduce. Now, what does this mean? What does this mean to the interpretation of history? Thank you. conveyance of truth is the mind of God. It means that the truth derives its meaning from God, which is to say that the events of the truth derive their meaning from God.
You to the rise of transcendentalism in this country, but however, I came to realize that I should have treated one more topic, a very important topic, before I introduced transcendentalism, and that is the nature of the Federal Union. It is quite obvious that in thinking of the members of the Philadelphia Convention and of the state legislatures, that the states, note what I'm saying, the states were to be the governing bodies which would reflect the biblical injunctions in Romans 13. It is the states which actually apply the law and not the federal government. I would remind you that even today, when the federal courts in the various states are in operation, they must decide the cases before them in terms of the law of that state. In other words, law in the sense in which we're discussing it in this particular lecture is that of the state. Now you say, well, is the federal government exempt from that? By no means. Chief Justice John Marshall, when he came to the court in 1801, had in mind a great deal more than some people realize, and was a far greater justice than some today are willing to grant to him. He was a good jurist. And in a case in 1819, the very celebrated McCulloch versus Maryland case, Chief Justice laid down a dictum which the federal government should have followed. And if it had followed this dictum, it would have saved this nation many, many hours of turmoil, many years of turmoil. The dictum was this, and I quote from McCulloch versus Maryland: "Let the end be legitimate. Let it be within the scope of the Constitution. And then all laws made in pursuance to these ideas are in themselves legal." In other words, what he meant to say was that if the end is legitimate. Now, what did he mean by that? He meant is the end of the act of the legislative activity of Congress, is the purpose of law of Congress. And he was talking here particularly, of course, of Congress. Is that law within the scope, not of the Constitution, to be sure, but also the first clause is even more important. Let it be legitimate. Now, what did he mean by that? What did he have in mind? If you read Marshall's decisions very carefully, not merely the McCulloch case, but the Dartmouth College case, which he settled the same year, and the case involving Aaron Burr in a different situation, and his other decisions, you will find that that Marshall had in mind the legitimacy of the acts of government. If the acts of government are legitimate, if they have a legitimate purpose, and by legitimate he meant in terms of biblical principles, the idea of the covenant. I want to impress this upon you, because this today raises many questions. We have a Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. And you know it as well as I do. And there's one phrase in there which was inserted, which makes it very valuable, very important, and that is, under God. This nation under God. Under God. Now, what did that mean? Well, the beginning of that Pledge of Allegiance is, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States and to the watch and to the republic for which it stands. Now, the republic stood in those days for a very important concept, namely the sovereignty of the state, an idea which is vanishing, to be sure, but in the law is still with us in the requirement that the federal courts use the state law. This is extremely important, and it would have changed the history of our country if these ideas involved in McCulloch versus Maryland, and not only to them, because these ideas were not particularly novel with Marshall. They were novel in the sense that he wrote them into a Supreme Court decision of great importance. If they had been observed in the 19th century and in the 20th century, what a difference what a vast difference would be the history of this country. And now I come back to transcendentalism. I beg your indulgence in not bringing this in before, but I was watching the time and I didn't want to go too long. Now, what was transcendentalism? It was a philosophy. It was a philosophy, however, which had large theological implications. The word transcendental had been developed by Immanuel Kant in his three great works, which I don't need to go into, but what he was trying to do was to develop a transcendental philosophy which would partake of the best, what he thought were the best parts of the rationalist school of thought, and also the empirical school of thought of Locke and his successors. In other words, he wanted to combine these two humanistic concepts of philosophy into one grand scheme, known as the transcendental approach. And from this came, I said, English idealism and the many poets and the writers of the first 50 years of the 19th century in England. And it came to this country. This movement came to this country and settled in New England. Why did it settle there? Well, New England is a large portion of the eastern part of New England, the more settled part, had been inundated by deism. A very cold religion and philosophy developed from the scientific outlook of the 17th century. It was cold, and if you weren't a good mathematician, you couldn't be much of a deist. It did not appeal largely to the common people, although there were some, of course, but it was not a widespread religion or philosophy. On the other hand, transcendentalism was warm. It wasn't deistic. It didn't separate God and man by a vast distance. It was pantheistic. It brought God and man together into a pantheistic union. And therefore, it proved to be more popular, perhaps much more popular. I'm not willing to say how much more popular. We don't have any, of course, Gallup polls of that day to indicate just how people believe. But we do know that this philosophy gained a great foothold in the Illuminati of New England, those who followed the French Revolution, and those who were against evangelical Christianity but were hunting a new home. And so it developed, and his great spokesmen, of course, were Henry Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and that group of writers. You'll notice I did not mention Henry Wadsworth Longfellow for one reason. As you study Longfellow, as I have tried to do, you will find this, which Hiawatha and the Record of the Hesperus and Paul Revere do not reflect a transcendental attitude. Thoreau did, William Cullen Bryant did, and the others. And it is this to which we must turn our attention. This philosophy, which, well, received its first important notice in the ordination service preached in 1819 for Jared Sparks, who was ordained as the pastor of and installed as the pastor of the Unitarian Church in Baltimore, Maryland. It was this event which focused on the theological aspects and the theological hopes of the transcendentalist movement and gave it a boost in popularity, so that we can say from, I suppose, if you want to take a round figure, a date figure, the year 1819, 1820 might be regarded as the beginning of a very important philosophical movement in this country. It was to have very important actions for the political, the social, the religious, the educational, and the economic life in what has been called the age of social ferment. Because transcendentalism, unlike deism, touched the hand, if I might use that phrase, it touched the nerve cord of all the important aspects of American culture and drastically changed them. And it is here that we find the theological development leading towards denial of God, leading toward a denial of Christianity in the Transcendentalist movement, which became very popular in the North and even the Northern churches. They departed from that traditional orthodoxy which had given birth to the American Republic. In the South, that was not the case. And it is to this that I shall now call your attention as we further pursue this concept of Transcendentalism and what it was doing to the American people and what it was doing to the American nation. It soon became quite evident that this new radicalism of the 19th century was a distinct threat to the older radicalism of the late 18th century and to the established order of the older Unitarianism, which had a stronghold in Harvard College and around Boston in general. Many of the congregational pulpits in Boston were shocked and aroused. Not only was Transcendentalism more radical in theology, or lack of it, but it was also much more radical in its social and political outlook than the older Unitarianism. This new movement constituted a distinct threat, not only to the established religious order, so dear even to the hearts of liberals, but it also endangered the whole political and social structure, which was New England. The fears it engendered among its liberal and conservative opponents was though by no means unfounded. For the very nature of Transcendentalism conferred upon it a peculiar affinity with sympathy for and understanding of the various radical movements which were part of the age of Jackson. And it was largely through this relationship to Jacksonian democracy that the movement was able to exert such a profound influence upon the political and the social development of this country from 1830s, certainly about 1860 or so. It spawned this movement, this new liberalism, this new Transcendentalism, spawned many, many reform movements. A demand for reform in the labor movement. A demand for reform in women. It really fostered the first women's rights movement, the first feminist movement. And that was largely done by Fanny Wright, who had come from Scotland to this country, and she immediately tried to take up with Mr. Emerson. Now, Mr. Emerson was a radically religious belief, but Fanny Wright was too much for him because she advocated free love, and he suggested she go elsewhere, and she did. She went to Robert Owen, the New Harmony Colony in Indiana, and there she found a very fine welcome. So, this new Transcendentalism sponsored and spawned the women's movement. It spawned a religious philosophy, a heretical outlook on religion, which I shall come back to. It spawned the free love movement, although that was not the most prominent part, I must admit. But it did spawn and did give birth to a growing laxity in morals among its own members and a new a sense of freedom from biblical, what they regarded as biblical distinctions or restrictions. And it also involved the labor movement. It involved women's dress. It involved the peace movement. It involved, and above all, the abolitionist movement. And it virtually captured the abolitionist movement. And this is the point I'm going to have to make, that the abolitionist movement, for the most part, in its leadership, and I want you to understand what I say very, very carefully here, in its leadership, was largely radical in its religious outlook. There were only a few evangelicals in the leadership of the abolitionist movement. Now, I do not mean to imply that evangelicals of that day did not take part in. I do not know the count, but I'm quite sure they did. But there were a few leaders who did maintain an evangelical outlook and still take part in the abolition movement. But they were in a distinct minority. Jonathan Blanchard of Wheaton College, the founder of Wheaton College, as a matter of fact, was one of these. So the time from 1820 to certainly 1860-65 can be called the age of ferment, the age of social ferment, the age of social unrest, and many, many movements, many religious movements were a part of this growing problem, and it did affiliate with Jacksonian democracy. Now, I do not mean that openly, but I mean that there's a great deal of sympathy between the followers of Jackson, who were dedicated to democracy and the Transcendentalist movement, because the Transcendentalist movement did foster a democratic philosophy in church and state. Now what happened was this, and I want to concentrate with you today on the religious aspect of it and abolitionism. I mentioned that the radicals were largely in control of the abolitionist movement, but we have to look at this more closely. for the Transcendentalist movement had a profound impact upon the church. This began in New England when it spawned what we might call the New England theology, which grew in popularity, say from 1810 on, and was headed by Timothy Dwight, although he was not as radical, nearly as radical as Fenelon, and Jonathan Edwards Jr., men like this, Nathaniel Taylor, they became a part of a movement which was in open revolt against Calvinism, particularly against the doctrine of election and the doctrine of substitutionary atonement, the vital parts of Calvinism, the vital parts of a covenant theology. This took a religious form in the New Unitarianism, which is more radical than New England philosophy, New England theology. But the New England theology was the first inkling, the first harbinger of what was to come. The New England theology did not repudiate Christianity. I certainly don't mean to imply that it did, but it did repudiate the Calvinism which had made this country so great. And this was the danger. Out of this New England theology came a serious break in the Presbyterian Church between the growing liberal element, which was largely influenced by New England theology, and the conservative element, which stood steadfast on the Adopting Act of 1729. This steadfast conservatism was found around Princeton, now the Princeton Seminary, the College of New Jersey. This became the bulwark, the stalwart bulwark of orthodoxy. But as the nation moved west, as a result of the Plan of Union of 1801 between the Presbyterians and the Connecticut Congregationalists, the movement westward from Pennsylvania on, taking up the settling in the old Northwest, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan later, and then Albany, Wisconsin. In these five states, the Congregational became the leaders. They took over, and Presbyterianism, as it was, became quite liberal in the New School movement. And finally, after some upheavals, in 1837, the Old School was able to gain the strength in the General Assembly, and it removed from its role the liberal Western seminaries, which were New School. So that you now have, from 1837 on, an Old School Presbyterian Church, stalwart in its Calvinism, stalwart in its biblical holding, with its great strength, with the Hodges and their successors at Princeton Seminary. And you have, apart from that, you have the growing influence of the New School, which was much less Calvinistic, much less Presbyterian, actually. It was an Arminian school. It was an Arminian group, and the New School fell to the radicalism of the day, and it supported the radical causes. One of its chief exponents was, of course, Charles G. Finney, who went to the very brink of Arminianism into heresy with his insistence that man can originate and carry out most of his own salvation. That was sheer radicalism. And he also was an ardent supporter of the abolitionist movement. And the abolitionist movement then became the home of the religious radicals. I don't mean to imply that all the religious radicals were abolitionists, but as far as I know, they were. On the other hand, the religious conservatives, particularly in not only in the Presbyterian Church, but in the Methodist Church and in the Baptist denomination, these held to the time-honored doctrinal standards of their respective churches. But the cleavage and the break became particularly noticeable, became particularly important in the Presbyterian Church because of the development of a new school, which not only was liberal in its theology, but was also obviously liberal in its social and its political and its economic outlook. Liberalism and theology breeds this religious, this political and social and economic liberalism with which the country is actually cursed today. But back to the day, what was this liberalism? What was the religious outlook of the Transcendentalists? What did they say? Well, I'm going to read you the idea, a few ideas, to show you what they were thinking. I'm going to quote from Theodore Parker, who was one of the leading of these people, leading of the Transcendentalists. I'm printing from his work, the centenary edition of Boston of 1907 in volume 6. Said he, the problem of the transcendental philosophy is no less than this, to revise the experience of mankind and his teachings by the nature of mankind, to test ethics by conscience, science by reason, to try the creeds of the churches, the constitution of the states by the constitution of the universe, to revise what is wrong, supply what is wanting, and command the just. So said Theodore Parker. That is a revolutionary statement. A revolutionary statement in regard to the political nature of the country. George Ripley gave another explanation. He also spoke to the point of what this supernatural, what transcendentalism was. Said he, the time has come when a revision of theology is demanded. Let the study of theology commence with the study of human consciousness. Oh, no, note here. The study of theology was to start not with God, not with the scriptures, but with the study of human consciousness. Where do we hear this? We hear this today again and again and again among liberals. Said he, let us ascertain what is meant by the expression, the image of God in the soul of man. Let us determine whether our nature has any revelation of the deity within itself. If we then discover a criterion of truth, as we firmly believe we shall, we can pass judgment on the spiritual and the infinite. Man can pass judgment on the spiritual and on the infinite. We shall then be prepared to examine the claims of divine revelation in history. Uh-huh. You see here? George Ripley is ready to Ripley, excuse me, I had to get a drink, and I will continue. Said Ripley, the religious man is indeed conversant with invisible objects. His thoughts expiate to regions which the eye hath not seen, but which God hath revealed to him by his Spirit. He reposes a firm faith in those ideas which are made known by his reason, now capital R for reason, as in those facts which are presented to his notice by the senses. He has no belief that human nature is so shackled and hemmed in upon its present imperfect state as to be confined to the objects made known by the eye of sense, which is given to us merely for the purpose of our temporal existence, and is incapable of ascending to those higher spheres of thought and reality to which the eternal elements of our being belong. It is quite obvious, I think, that in spite of its apparent insistence on the transcendental quality of religious experience and its frequent reference to God, this religious philosophy was in essence a religion of man. It was humanistic to the core. To the transcendentalist mind, God had no existence outside of the human consciousness. William Mallory Channing, its great spokesman in the pulpit, made this very clear. Said he, the idea of God, sublime and awful as it is the idea of our own spiritual nature, purified and enlarged to infinity. In ourselves are the elements of divinity. The only God whom our thought can rest upon, and our hearts cling to, and our conscience recognize, is the God whose image dwells in our own souls. This is what was going on in the North. What they wanted to do was to reconstruct all previous theology, Calvinistic, evangelical, and also Unitarian. And the result would be a man-centered system of thought and humanistic conception of life. in a very real sense, man was both the source of his religious knowledge, according to them, and his religious experience, and the sole judge of the validity of his religious knowledge and religious experience. If he did not create God in his own image, he at least, in my opinion, was called upon to be a co-equal of that God. And they were but mutually independent, or I should say dependent, upon one another. Now, it is true that Transcendentalism was never a formally organized movement, in spite of the fact that a club was formed for the formation and advancement of this philosophy in 1836 by Frederick Hedge, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and George Ripley in Boston, and it undertook the publish of Guile to popularize its position. But the group was always informal, and the Guile did not last but a few years. So now we go to what was really the point of all this. The point of it was that Transcendentalism was a revolt against all previous American theological systems. As I said, Calvinistic, Evangelical, Arminian, and even Unitarianism. It was not only a revolt in the sense of a protest, but at the same time it was a conscious effort to reform theology in terms of its own basic postulates. The ridicule which Oliver Wendell Holmes heaped upon Calvinism in his famous poem, The One Horse Shave, was paralleled by other equally critical attacks on the older Unitarianism, which had its roots in the Enlightenment of the 18th century. Theodore Parker, one of its most vociferous exponents, believed it was his duty to reform the whole of Christianity, and not just any one segment of it. But there can be no doubt that Theodore Parker, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and their fellow laborers reserved for Calvinism their most bitter scorn and most severe attacks. Now, in doing this, they were also attacking, at that very same time, the whole conception of a covenant, a political covenant embedded in the law and the structure of the American system, and also of covenant theology, of course, which is the home and the root of all covenant thinking. And so, it spawned a radicalism, a very severe radicalism, and I would like to show what I'm talking about here. What did they really think? I want to quote from Emerson. Said Emerson, "What is a man born for, but to be a reformer?" Good question. "A remarker of what man has made, imitating that great nature, capital N, which embosoms us all, and which sleeps no moment on an old past, but every hour repairs ourselves, yielding to us every morning a new day, and with every pulsation a new life." This is, of course, social and evolution. Before Darwin, it was the evolutionary concepts which were embedded in this philosophical movement. And so in 1841, so said the Dial. I've mentioned this before, and I quote, "The triumph of reform is sounding through the world for a revolution of all human affairs. Already is the axe laid at that root of that spreading tree whose trunk is idolatry, whose branches are covetousness, war, and slavery." And here it comes. The Transcendentalists leveled their attacks against slavery and, because it came, abolitionists. "Against slavery, whose blossom is concupiscence, whose fruit is hate. Planted by bells above, it shall be rooted up. Reformers are metallic. They are sharp as steel. They perceive whatsoever evil or abuse they touch." I would like to read to you one more quote here. And this is from Albert Brisbane, one of the most unknown writers, I guess, in that period of American history. But he was a socialist and a radical of great importance in his own thinking. Said he, and I quote from a book which is not well known, but which should be well known, The Social Destiny of Man, which was published in Philadelphia in 1840. Albert Brisbane. "Nature has implanted in man an instinct of social progress, which, it is true, will lead him through a series of transformations to the attainment of his destiny, but she has also reserved his intelligence the noble prerogative of hastening this progress and of anticipating results which, if left to the gradual movement of society, would require centuries to effect." Here you have the open adaptation of Hegelian dialectical logic to social and economic questions. This is, of course, late years later, Karl Marx would do this in his writings. But now Arthur Brisbane has anticipated it by adapting the concept of evolution to a social progress. He says this is what is in man, the social progress. It will lead him through a series of transformations. This was the Hegelian dialectic at work. I've given you two or three quotes from the Transcendentalists to show you what was going on. And this is extremely important. Now, in 1846, Theodore Parker preached a sermon on merchants. Now the merchants in America occupy the place which was once held by the fighters and next by the nobles. In virtue of its strength and position, this class is the controlling one in politics. Your Congress is its mirror. The class is controlling one in the churches. It is the same way buying up the clergymen. The clergymen will do its work, putting them in comfortable places. The merchants will build mainly the churches and endow the theological schools. They furnish the material sinews of the church. Hence, the metropolitan churches are in general as much commercial as shops. This class owns the machinery society. It, in great measure, the ships, the factories, the shops, the water privileges, houses, and the like. This brings into their employment large masses of workers with no capital but muscles and skill. You have here an open preparation for communism of the Marxian type. Theodore Parker was probably the most radical of all the transcendentalists along these lines, making sweeping statements. And he edited a paper called The Harbinger, in which he gave voice to his aims. Now, because prevalent in the South, the transcendentalists, the abolitionists, and their like, their ilk, I guess I should say, felt that this was the place where they should begin to work. And it was here, friends, unfortunately, that they were to win their most ultimate victory. They felt that slavery was wrong. They felt that it must be eliminated, not just contained to the old states of the South, and forbidden in the newer territories, but it must be uprooted, lock, stock, and barrel. Thus, transcendentalism and the abolitionists were to engage, and they did engage, in a reform movement, which, of course, eventually led to war. They aligned themselves with democratic forces of Jacksonian democracy, and they became a powerful segment in American society. They were willing to attack property rights in favor of human rights. All too frequently, their only justification was based on the assumption that they represented what the people at large wanted. And just as frequently, little attention was paid to the basic justice and the rightness of such programs. In other words, the transcendental abolitionists paid little attention to the rightness of their programs. And this was true in regard to labor reform, in regard to war and peace and whatnot. They did not pay any attention or any much attention to the basic situation, but simply said, this is what must be. Frequently, these reform programs have been influenced by European political and social philosophers. There's no doubt that Albert Brisbane was being influenced by European socialism, as was Theodore Parker. Inevitably, the Puritan world and life view had become almost extinct and practically without influence in determining national policy. And of course, this has been true, even more true today, but it was becoming true in that day. Now, had this effect upon us? What was the effect upon the South? This is what I think we need to consider very clearly, because I've been asked to lecture to you on the religious aspect of the war or of secession. The South, for interesting reasons, did not become the home of the transcendentalist movement. there was almost no transcendentalism in what we today call the Old South. There was some in Kentucky at Transylvania University, but not in the 11 states which formed the Confederacy. There was very, very little of this type of thing. I'm not saying there wasn't any, because that would not be a generalization, but at no time did abolitionism, at no time did the overriding transcendentalism as a philosophy which produced the abolitionism, at no time did that philosophy rear its